Premier Christian Newscast.
It's not just British denominations which are splintering under the weight of their divisions. The United Methodist Church in the United States has also gone through a painful few years of divorce, with up to one in four congregations ultimately choosing to leave. The crisis was, inevitably, precipitated by deep disagreements over LGBT issues, including same-sex marriage. When a crunch vote in their assembly came, the Conservatives won, and yet it has been the Conservative churches which have left, some to a brand new breakaway denomination. In some ways, the split has been amicable and orderly, and yet has also caused huge pain for others on both sides. I'm Tim Wyatt, and this is the Premier Christian Newscast. This week, we have a blockbuster panel of guests, journalists, theologians, and bishops, to discuss the schism in the United Methodist Church. What does the future hold, both for the conservative churches which have left, and for those who have remained? And is the path of mutually agreed separation a good model for other denominations experiencing similar fractures? Brilliant. Well, thanks everyone for joining us on the show today. Could I ask each of you just to briefly introduce yourself and your own connection to the Methodist world, such as it is? Heather, why don't you go first?
I'm Heather Hahn. I'm with United Methodist News, and my task for the past 4 years has been following our church disaffiliations, and we'll hear about that a little bit more. Thank you.
Brilliant. Timothy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, Timothy Tennant. I have about 15 years served as the president of Asbury Theological Seminary, and for 40 years ordained ministry in the United Methodist Church, and more recently in the last year have come a member of the Global Methodist Church.
Brilliant. Bishop Gregory.
I'm Gregory Palmer, and I am finishing 24 years as a bishop of the United Methodist Church, and am serving currently in the West Ohio Conference.
Megan, who are you?
My name's Megan Fowler. I am a religion journalist and contributing writer for Christianity Today magazine, and I am one of several reporters with Christianity Today who has been covering the disaffiliation process with the United Methodist Church since about 2019.
And last but very much not least, Tom.
I'm Bishop Tom Berlin. I'm unlike Bishop Palmer, I've served 14 months as a bishop in the United Methodist Church, and I've been a part of the discussions in the United Methodist Church leading up to all that you're discussing today.
Brilliant. Well, I'm so pleased to have such a wide-ranging and well-experienced panel on this story. Before we dive into the meat of the story, I think it'd be helpful for our listeners and for me, if I'm honest, to kind of give a little bit of background about the United Methodist Church. Could someone give us a bit kind of the critical information? How big is it? What is historical origins? What kind of churches featuring in there? How diverse theologically has it been? Heather, would you be a good person for that?
It was okay, y'all, if I do that. Okay, sorry. Well, so we come from the mother country of Britain. That's where we started. John Wesley was our founder, and he was born in 1703, died in 1791. He spread this to the then American colonies fairly early on, and in fact, he had an experience in Georgia that didn't really set well with him, and that was his last time in what was then the American colonies. He goes back to England, but then he sends people here, and we are growing by gangbusters, and the Revolutionary War happens. Wesley himself, not a fan, but when the Revolutionary War is over, the Anglicans that were here all go either to Canada or most of them go back to England, and there's no priest to perform communion. And so Wesley says, okay, I'm going to start ordaining fellow priests, which was weird. And he does it. And he sends people over here. And in 1784, we're officially founded as the Methodist Episcopal Church. Methodist, because we're Methodist. Episcopal, because we've got bishops and church. And so that's sort of where we are. And that's sort of how we are. Now, today, we are a diverse denomination that is not just based in the U.S. We are on four continents, from and U.S. and North America. We're in Western Europe, but not in England. We have good relations with Methodist Church in England, but they are a separate denomination. And we have relations. We are part of. We are the Methodist expression in the Philippines, and we are all over the African continent. So we're on four continents. And we are a theologically diverse thing. And the thing I just want to drive home is, if you, even though we're very theologically diverse and we're very big and international now, if you want to follow American history, and if you're fascinated by it, you would do so much worse than just following what's going on in the Methodist Episcopal Church throughout American history. You can follow what's going on in American history by following, and vice versa. We are just this good emblem of what's going on in the state at any given time. So anyhow, hope that helped. Thank you so much. And feel free, the scholars amongst you, to, you know, add.
Timothy, anything you'd want to chip in on that kind of pen portrait of the church?
I would just add somewhat, maybe tongue-in-cheek, but it is true that one of those priests who did not go back, of course, was Francis Asbury, who arrived at 26 years old, never returned. And so part of what was so challenging was that so many churches were being planted during that time. And they later on, when they had the Christmas conference, had to find a way to baptize thousands of new believers. So I do want to appreciate Francis Asbury for staying in the colonies and living here during those difficult years of the revolution.
And Gregory, yourself and Tom are a bit of a clue for us British listeners. We're quite used to the idea that Methodists in our country don't have bishops, whereas your church has had bishops from day one. Is that right?
More or less, yes, it is right. Of course, Mr. Wesley accommodated the matter. He was not enthusiastic about it. I think the academics will agree with that. But it was a concession to the understanding of the mission field.
And bishops today in the church, do they play a kind of similar role in terms of their authority, their responsibilities, as they would in the Episcopal Church, or as we would call it, the Anglican Church?
I would say yes, in terms of leadership of adjudicatory. So diocese and conference are synonyms in our world. And but I would say in some ways, the same role. I think my observation, having worked as the co-chair of the United Methodist Episcopal Dialogue, or the Episcopal United Methodist Bilateral, and we are in an interim shared Eucharist as United Methodists with the Episcopal Church here, is that the bishop is related to the diocese somewhat differently than our bishops are. And let me illustrate and be specific. So many shared symbolic roles, but the diocese elects the bishop. We are elected in larger bodies. We call them central conferences or jurisdictions in the United States. And then we are deployed. So Bishop Berlin and I stood for election at our respective times. And we knew that we could go to one of 10 places, but we didn't know the place we would end up. That assignment is done by a body of people called the Episcopacy Committee and the delegates to the General Conference. So how we get to a specific location is different. Election is similar, done by the people of the conference, in not a specific conference, but the aggregate conferences in a jurisdiction or a central conference. So some yes and some no. I don't know that we have quite as strong a doctrinal and by the canon laws an understanding that the Episcopalians do, or the Anglicans, that, and I quote now, the bishop constitutes the diocese. And on the other hand, if you're a United Methodist, you can't be a United Methodist and not have a bishop. So if you feel that little bit of tension there, that may be probably that much information won't even buy you a cup of coffee, but it's a nuanced kind of difference. And the other is size. So I have two Episcopal counterparts in the state of Ohio, and there are two United Methodist bishops. But the comparison in number of churches and clergy in the diocese versus either the West or the East Ohio Conference is exponentially different. And I think the same, let me toss the ball to Bishop Berlin.
I think he's covered it beautifully, thank you.
All right, well, that's really helpful kind of background information for those who haven't come across the United Methodist Church before. Let's come to our kind of current crisis, if I can use that language. If we wind the clock back maybe 5, maybe let's say 10 years, where did the church stand when it's on kind of conflict between, again, broad labels, but kind of people who are more conservative, people who might be more liberal? Megan, do you want to sketch out a little bit about the kind of internal church politics that might have precipitated the kind of disaffiliation moment?
Sure. So in 2019, there was gathering. Was it a general conference? Was that the right word? Okay.
Special session. Yeah.
A special session for the purpose of navigating a way forward when it came to issues of human sexuality and where the denomination would stand. And, you know, I think a couple things that are helpful to know is in the United States, United Methodist Church is the second largest Protestant denomination. It's huge. At one point, there was close to, 30,000 churches. So we're talking a huge denomination that spans the entire country, but also the place where the United Methodist Church is growing rapidly is in Africa. So I think the number of adherents in the U.S. and on the African continent are neck and neck, and Africa might have just surpassed the U.S. So that's, you kind of sense a tension there. So you have kind of the views in the West, and then the places where Methodism is really growing in Africa, and you bring those people together to vote on the future direction of the denomination. And they voted for what was called the traditional plan, which was to keep in place the Book of Discipline. The Book of Discipline is the a policy book, for lack of a better term, doctrinal book standard, what United Methodists believe. And they voted in 2019 to keep in place language that would, marriage is between one man and one woman for life. I think that's my understanding.
Heather.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and there's a little bit more to it.
Sure.
Quick, yeah, if you don't mind. So, yes, we have two main policies that are, well, three. First of all, our social principles since 1972 have said that the practice, and please listen to this word, practice of homosexuality, ... is incompatible with Christian teaching. So that's part of our social principles and has been a source of contention since, frankly, 1972, and that has grown. Since then, and the social principles are social teachings. Since then, that started in subsequent general conferences. They eventually added it to essentially our church law, which is a different thing than social teachings. And that's basically that we currently ban self-avowed practicing, and the word is homosexual, I'll just say gay clergy, but self-avowed practicing, that's from the discipline. And we also, as she mentioned, we ban the officiation and hosting of same-sex weddings. And we currently, in the discipline, and frankly, in the social principles, define marriage between one man and one woman. We don't say for life. We do actually acknowledge the existence of divorce, but that's was actually a source of contention back and when. But so that's where we currently stand. Is that okay for me to add that?
Yeah. Just so I'm really clear. So in 2019, the teacher's official doctrine and teaching is that it does not approve of same-sex relationships and gay clergy are not allowed and weddings can't happen in United Methodist churches. And that is a point of contention. There are people within the church who both strongly support that position and people who would strongly like it to change, and presumably some people somewhere in the middle. Would anyone be able to kind of give us a sense of kind of proportions or numbers, or, yes, or how did that division play out within the church?
So specifically that vote, that and so you need to know the traditional plan aimed at increasing enforcement of these longstanding, well, decade-long positions. And that decade, and at that point, the vote was 438 to 384. So about 53% of the delegates who were at our general conference in 2019 voted for it. And the votes are by secret ballot. So I could not tell you necessarily the breakdown of people smarter than me might be able to do that. But I can tell you that it was pretty clear that from just looking at people's discussion that, yes, the vast majority of support came from the African continent. The vast majority of people who did not support this came from the US and from Western Europe. So there you go.
And Timothy, it might confuse some people listening to hear that, hang on, the kind of conservatives won, if I can use that crude language, in the vote in 2019, and yet it is, you know, 5-6 years later, it is mostly conservative churches that are leaving United Methodist Church. How did that come about?
Okay, I think I got your question. You freeze up, but yeah, I think there's been, 40 votes on this over the years since 1972. As Heather mentioned, this was voted on every general conference and then the special conference as well. But I think what is probably not understood, probably by your listeners, is that back in 2013, which is some years back, one of the retired bishops of the church, Melvin Talbert, came to Alabama and officiated over a same-sex wedding. That was October of 2013. And that began really a lot of widespread opposition to the Book of Discipline by many, many churches throughout the country, all across the country, in fact, not just in the Northwest and the New England, but across the country. Quite a few churches just chose not to abide by the discipline. So by the time we get to 2019, the vote, which, as Heather pointed and Megan pointed, was in fact 438 to 384, it actually didn't really matter that much because there wasn't the will to enforce that position. And therefore, at the end of the day, the legislative side, I mean, it still hasn't changed to this day, but it still hasn't really been able to be enforced properly by the practice of the church, judicial council, et cetera. So in that sense, that made a difference in how that vote was interpreted by conservatives.
And so is it fair to say that conservatives, at least in the United States, felt that the church was kind of drifting away from their preference, and that even though technically the kind of doctrines were in line with how they would have preferred it, they no longer had confidence that those doctrines would be kind of upheld or enforced?
Yeah, I think another thing that I think Heather alluded to, which is really a very important point, which is that this actually goes back 52 years. It's not something that started in 2016 or 2019. This goes back 52 years when the church was first merged in 68, the United Methodist Church became the Methodist Church with the United Brethren churches. When those churches were united and formed what today is called the United Methodist Church, they put in place a special commission to study theology, doctrine, etc. And they came back in 1972 with a document called Our Theological Task, which adopted theological pluralism. So at that point, I feel like that was the point where the church more or less officially, though it wasn't in the doctrinal standards, it was in another document, but it did create at least a big change in the way the church understood it. Things like the quadrilateral, a lot of things came from that conversation, which I think has dominated a lot of conversation in church about the UMC being a place of theological diversity. It goes way long before any discussion about same-sex marriage. So to me, the whole shift happened 50 years ago, and this is just the latest example of it.
So could I, Dr. Tennant, not in a spirit of disagreement, but just on the timing, you talked about Our Theological Task coming in 1972, and you're absolutely correct. the report on the social that the commission, the 68 conference created a commission on the social principles. They presented what does include the incompatibility clause at the same exact time, 1972. So please don't hear that as a picking a fight, simply saying maybe it's that convergence that may be at work, but they were at the same time, not sort of successive.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think by 88, probably 88, they removed that a lot of the language of the theological document. But yeah, that's actually a good point. It did, in fact, sharpen the points of both sides of the church from that point on.
And Tom, I understand that you were involved in the commission that was kind of helping prepare the recommendations for this special session in 2019. Could you talk us through a little bit about what that process was like and how was it quite tense? Was it quite divisive trying to come up with a way forward in the face of this quite entrenched disagreement within the church?
Yeah, I think the desire was to fulfill the unity of the body of Christ. Jesus, we know, prayed for that we would be one as he and the Father are one. I think that all participants, it was a highly representative group from our global church, included people who wanted the church to be more inclusive, included people that wanted to hold to the traditional view on marriage and ordination and the other matters we've discussed. I think the group worked in very good faith. We worked for over a year. Bishop Palmer was in that group as well. I feel that people had adequate opportunity to share their views. We eventually came to the point where we were putting together something that was called the One Church Plan. The desire of the One Church Plan was to create a space where people would have contextual choice. We understand that United Methodists in Africa are very different from United Methodists in Western Europe, are very different from United Methodists in the United States, that those geographical spaces have cultural expressions, a variety of cultural expressions, that have different views on the practice of homosexuality. The One Church Plan attempted to create a way that people could have that contextualization and a practice that would follow that and would not force any pastor to perform a wedding and not perform any church to hold a wedding, but would give the opportunity to do so. I know that one of the big turning points in those conversations for me is when, during a break, one of the more traditional members, someone who has really helped create the new expression of Methodism, the Global Methodist Church, they said, you know, I know you're working really hard to find a way we can all stay together, but if there is any solution that involves gay people being married, I'm out. And everybody is out. And what they are helping me understand is that some United Methodists are compatibilists. They can be with people they disagree with, but still stay in the church together. And some are incompatibilists, that if you disagree with them on this issue and that same gender marriage and ordination of gay persons, these are sufficient issues for division. And so I don't really like the liberal conservative, progressive conservative labels, because in the United Methodist Church today, we have people who might use the term liberal or progressive. We have United Methodists who would say conservative. And how they hold their political ideology is not a predictor of how they feel about same-gender marriage. And so you have to be really careful with your terms, but the compatibilist and the incompatibilist, that tends to be a phrasing that is predictive of where people end up after the conversation is held.
Okay, so Megan, if I can come to you. So we've had this big kind of crunch vote in 2019. Bishop Tom's One Church Plan loses out to the traditional plan, which, as I said, is ostensibly a kind of victory for those who want to hold on to traditional teaching and leave it unchanged. And yet it sets in motion the kind of split, the disaffiliation process we've seen to this day. Could you explain how exactly that happens?
So I think there was some frustration from conservatives. I believe in the aftermath of this vote, there were some bishops who declared their intention to not abide by what had just been affirmed, what was in the Book of Discipline. And so there were some churches that were frustrated by that, and disappointed to hear that. You know, some of the top leadership in the denomination, you know, had expressed a desire to an intention not to respect this vote. And so they began using, there's a paragraph in the Book of Discipline, and it's called paragraph 2553. And it outlined some ways if a church desires to leave the denomination, it's called disaffiliating, because of reasons having to do with a disagreement over human sexuality. It outlined a process for making that possible. And then it's tricky. I think there was a plan, there was an intention that at the 2020 General Conference, which is an international gathering, they would hammer out a more detailed plan. But of course, that had to be postponed because of the pandemic. And then it has continued to be postponed. And so paragraph 2553 has become a way for churches to leave the denomination while they wait for an official, some people are calling it an official divorce decree, but an official way out. So it involves, it's a long process. It involves several meetings and communicating for churches to communicate with their regional leadership that they'd like to leave, and they need to vote on leaving, and that vote needs to be 2/3 of the congregation voting to leave. And then there are there's some payments that need to be made. Fee is not the right word. They need to pay, some dues that would be coming up, and pay.
If you don't mind,
Heather, do you want to chip in?
Yeah, Heather, go ahead.
It's okay. So what they're all, so yeah, what it basically is, and 2553 was instituted in 2019. So it didn't exist prior to 2019. And, and by the way, it currently is expired. So it's expired at the end of last year. So when we talk about these 4 years of 2019 and 2023, that's the time of 2553. And it basically led churches leave with property. And that's the key thing. People could always come and go from the United Methodist Church as they so chose. But the property is the big thing. And prior to this, and frankly, even still on the books, we have what we call the trust clause. And by the way, that trust clause that we have in the discipline, the language behind it was instituted by John Wesley himself in consultation with lawyers back in England in the 18th century. It's common law stuff. Anyhow, so we have the trust clause, but this basically gave you a way to sort of get a temporary release from the trust clause. And you had to follow the obligations were, as she mentioned, 2/3 vote from the church and the majority vote of your annual conference, which is the kind of, which is the judicatory that, Bishop Palmer and Bishop Berlin, they lead annual conferences. And so they had to get the majority vote of these people. And the obligations were financial, were pensions, and what we call apportionments, which is exactly what you mean by dues. Dues is a great way of putting it, but basically money that goes beyond the local church support ministries. And you have to do 2 years worth. And then also repay back certain loans. And if that's an issue for you, and you're also required to pay for the legal work, which is, nominal. But the other thing that is important to note about this particular paragraph is that it did let annual conference add to the basic requirements. So different annual conferences did have different standards. And we currently have, correct me if I'm wrong, 53 annual conferences in the U.S. So that's, and because of action taken by the 2019 General Conference, this particular passage ended up only applying in the U.S. That was not necessarily the original intent of how it was written, but that's what happened when basically in 2019, the General Conference, what they did was they approved legislation that said that this would only apply, legislation that was approved by the 2019 General Conference would only immediately apply in the U.S. and everything in the Central Conference would not apply in the Central Conferences, read all these regions outside the U.S., until 12 months after the coming General Conference. This was back when we thought General Conference was going to be in 2020 and nobody had heard of COVID-19. So hope that helps.
Thank you, Heather.
Premier Christian Newscast. Premier Christian Newscast.
And Timothy, can I come to you then? So in at the same time, this new church, the Global Methodist Church, is kind of springing into life as set up as a kind of a receptacle for parishes that were disaffiliating from the UMC. Could you tell us a bit about the GMC? Where does it come from? Who is involved in its in setting it up? What does it stand for?
Yeah, the Global Methodist Church, or GMC, actually came later. So you can go back in time, because when all this discussion was going on, we're talking about, that was actually another organization called the Wesley Covenant Association, the WCA. The WCA was creating a network of churches around the country that were in favor of obviously conservative Christianity, conservative historic Christianity, but also opposed to the way the trust clause is being interpreted by the denomination. So the result of that was, by the time the Global Methodist Church gets launched, that actually is much later. They already had this network of church. If I recall, Keith, the person who's the head of WCA became the head of the general leader of the Global Methodist Church. So the leadership was quite consistent throughout that. So that WCA movement actually led to May 1st, 2022, which more recently is when the GMC was actually launched. And as mentioned, around a third of the church has migrated from the United Methodist Church to the Global Methodist Church.
And is the Global Methodist Church set up in a kind of similar lines to the UMC, aside from kind of theology? Obviously, we understand it's a kind of more conservative leaning denomination, but is it otherwise set up to be kind of a similar type of body, similar structure,
right?
Similar governance?
No, it's not. But first of all, let me just say that there's no, shall I wait till you're close enough? But there is no current discipline, official discipline of the Global Methodist Church. Their first general conference will take place in September 20 to 26 in Costa Rica of this year. So right now they have a provisional discipline, which has been approved, which is not really in full force, but clearly they have a very different idea about the role of the episcopacy. So in the current setup of the GMC, what we would call bishops in my 40 years UMC is really more what's called the president pro tem of the different conferences of the GMC. And so basically the authority being pushed down to a much lower level. And there's only two bishops in the whole GMC. And I don't think when the conference happens, there'll be many more than that, maybe six or eight, but it's not going to be a lot of bishops. So the bishops there have much more of a teaching role, visionary role, but the administration of the church actually happened much lower. So in that sense, the structure is different. They don't have lifetime appointments. That's another big difference from the current setup of the United Methodist Church. So there are differences in the way the episcopacy understood. I would say it's a flatter church, more democratic church. I don't know that necessarily would be good, but they're definitely pushing toward more of a democratic approach to ecclesiology.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Tom, if I could ask you, I know you weren't a bishop throughout this process necessarily, but you've clearly been involved in a lot of the conversations. How was the departure, the disaffiliation of, you know, I think someone mentioned it's about a third of all the churches in the UMC at this point. How was that received by those staying behind? Was that seen as a huge sadness, as a kind of defeat, as a loss? Or was there a sense that actually this was a helpful parting of the ways of two tribes of Christians who could no longer agree, who were, you know, as you said, compatibilist or incompatibilist?
Yeah, I think in the scripture we can see that God's people don't always resolve their differences. And when they can't resolve differences, what's essential is that you part with a blessing. And so I think that the disaffiliation was sad. It's, you know, when you're watching your friends go and churches you used to attend go, or for clergy, churches they once had that left. I just think that's really hard work emotionally and spiritually, because separation is always difficult. You know, we as Christians believe we live in the kingdom of God now, and we'll live in the kingdom of God in its fullness and eternity. And so, you know, eventually you might as well figure out how to get along with people in this life, because you're going to be stuck with them in eternity, assuming we all believe that we have salvation in Christ. So I think that it was difficult. I think it was sad, but I think, I know in the Florida conference, we worked to make it, you know, is to do it in a way that was professional, to do it in a way that was fair. And we stuck to the provisions of 2553. And I actually had people departing thank me for the manner in which we managed all of this, that they felt blessed as they left. Our annual conference session literally blessed those that were departing as a sign act, so that we could experience healing ourselves and reconciliation ourselves as far as that was possible, given some of the things that were said about us and falsehoods that were spread about the United Methodist Church. It's been, you can't do this type of work without heightened tension, without heightened feelings and emotions. And that is sometimes expressed verbally and in ways that, you know, I leave it to God to judge and to convict those who acted inappropriately. And I think they will. And so I think God will. And I think that they'll have to deal with that in their own time.
Bishop Palmer, a similar question to you. What was the situation like in Ohio, and how did it feel? How was it handled, the departure, any departure of churches there?
Yes, we went in the course of 18 months from 961 congregations to right at 600 congregations. So it was very impactful in terms of numbers of congregations, and members and material resources. I was just talking before I got on to the call here with someone about the emotional toll and the relationships between, for example, clergy that had 40-year relationships, and those relationships in some cases are more fragile now if people are connecting at all. I don't think there's any universality to that. Some people have kept very strong friend, colleague relationships, but that's been a part of the toll that that we have played. I would say similarly, we had sign acts, ritualistic acts. Bishop Berlin referred to blessing those that were choosing to depart. I answered a question today on a town hall about the General Conference. The question was, will more conservative churches be forced out of the United Methodist Church? Which was an interesting framing. Probably, if I may venture my opinion, the question was framed by some caucus group. Somebody was, some person, lay or clergy, raised it. And I said, no congregation on my watch, but I don't know of any other watches, has been forced out. There's no conspiracy, organized conspiracy, to push congregations out. There is theological tension. There is tension about the exercise of missional ministry that happens. But that happens in every local church. When they have a discussion about should we engage, there's a robust discussion about how they engage their community and whether it's around hunger or homelessness or something. And sometimes that gets a little scrappy in a local congregation. But no one that I know of has been forced out. People may feel that they have been, quote, called out, but no one has been forced out. And I join the spirit of Jesus when he says, I desire that none be lost. I know that has a different eschatological implication, but I take no, I do not relish what we've been through and have no joy in it. And it's more for me now, less about the numbers, and it's more about looking at those tender relationships that are not what they used to be.
Yeah, Tim, if I might add, I think it's really important. It's very easy to use labels and terms that get us away from what we're really talking about. These are people. And many of us long for a church, and I can only speak for as a United Methodist in the United States, but many of us long for a church that will be fully inclusive of gay people. Because gay people are members of our family, they're in our communities, they're our coworkers, our colleagues, our doctors, these are people we live with and love and enjoy in many places. And we just like to see that happen in the church as well. And it's okay that not everybody believes that or accepts that. And I understand the varied opinions. But it's really important to remember at the end of this, in the church I used to serve, two women entered the vestibule and said, we're legally married in the United States, and these two children are our biological children, and we just want to know, how are we going to be treated, and are we fully included here? And they didn't mean we were hoping to ungay them, or we were hoping they would choose a different life. They meant, are you accepting of our family? And when we focus on people, this becomes most people have the ability to manage this conversation when we're talking about real life people in a way that we don't when we're arguing on a conference floor behind a microphone, or we're trying to get our opinion. I think for all of us, no matter where people ended up in this, when we really just talk about the people, it's quite different. But policies do impact people. And that's what much of this has been about. Mm-hmm.
Could I jump on the end of that, sure. Tim, the host, and to distinguish the Timothys on here? Bishop Berlin, you have spoken very well, and I've heard you describe that couple before from your last parish. And it's intriguing to me, the intersection of the strongest voices. We've got to get out of here because gay folks are going to take us over. I mean, that's some of the chatter you hear sometime, not from the more thoughtful voices, but it's a kind of a common parlance among some. And it's interesting that I believe and perceive and would venture that those same people tend to be strong, what I would call law and order people, meaning they respect law. And so it's interesting that now that same-gender marriage is legal in the United States, that's a place of discomfort. I'm not saying that they don't have a right for it to be uncomfortable, but it's just an interesting notation, a heavy commitment to uphold the law, and they're referring to civil and criminal law, but let's not uphold it here. Many of the same voices, and this is experiential for me, so I've not done a data-based study, would, when you have a conversation about arms, meaning firearms in the church building, people have argued on the basis of law, their right to carry them in the church, even though we lean strongly against it in United Methodist churches. So, you know, we're all a little bit twisted in the sense of inconsistency of where we zoom in.
If I could jump in here,
go for it.
Bishop Berlin and Bishop Palmer, it's interesting to hear your perspective, because I just know the churches that I have interviewed in the stories that I've covered for CT. And when I ask them, why do you want to leave, or what has this been about for you? A lot of them they say, we love the United Methodist Church. And it comes down to a different understanding of scripture. And it's been, you know, consistently, they've expressed the same sadness that you have. I talked to one pastor whose father was also a United Methodist pastor. And he said, my father and I we've gone to every single annual conference together, you know, every denominational gathering at the regional and the national level they had attended together. And he said, I will no longer do that. And he was sad. You know, there was no acrimony in their relationship. And I think that's something that I've also noticed in the churches the pastors and the clergy and the lay leaders that I have interviewed, there has been a tremendous lack of acrimony, sometimes discouragement, sometimes disappointment, but a real sense that these are brothers and sisters in Christ. We don't want to be an angry church. That doesn't honor Christ. That doesn't further the mission of the gospel. But we want to serve the Lord faithfully, and being faithful to how God has called us means not being United Methodist. And so I want to emphasize that in the churches that I've talked with, there's been a real sense of wanting the United Methodist Church to continue to be involved in gospel ministry. And churches that, whether they're joining the Global Methodist Church or whether they're just going to be independent, that they want to serve their communities and honor the Lord, and they want the United Methodist Church. They kind of, you know, wish the United Methodist Church well on its way.
Megan, I think there's a lot of truth in what you just said. I would also say there's probably a big difference between being a reporter for Christianity Today and being a bishop in the United Methodist Church at an information meeting for people who want to leave the denomination. I wish that all of my experiences were as pleasant as those you describe, but I do believe that you are describing many, many people who have left the United Methodist Church. And I have experienced that myself, and I would agree with it. If you want to get on the acrimony side, I can take you back in time and we can do that. But I think you're better off doing your job the way you're doing it. I think you're probably a happier person that way.
Now, I want to speak for myself on this too, Tim.
Please.
I was ordained for 40 years in the UMC, and it was very, very sad for me. I was very, very late joining the GMC. I had endless people send emails weekly. Why had I not joined the GMC? Because I wasn't part of the WCA before it. I was not part of any of those movements. And it was very, very sad for me to leave the UMC. But I felt I had no more place or voice there. But I do think Gregory's right, Bishop Palmer's right, that no one forced me out, pushed me out. I did not experience that at all. And but I just felt like there was no more, I had no more voice. I do think that, I also want to say on behalf of the GMC, I do think that the vision of the GMC is to provide a warm, welcome embrace for all people that are gay, otherwise gender differently or whatever. So I think the goal and the hope of the GMC is to say it is damaging people to be in closeted situations where they can't come out and express where they are. That is dangerous to people. It's damaging to people. We think it's also highly hypocritical for to have focus on one sexual ethic violation, like same-sex marriage, but not adultery, pornography, a wide range of issues in people's sexual lives that need to be addressed. There's a lot of problems like that we want to address. But I do believe that when people come in with the full embrace of the gospel, we also are as equally committed to the transformation of all of God's people to conform to the ethics of Jesus in the New Testament. I think those are where the tension is, but I do think we, for at least our vision is to have more embrace, and I think we all hope for all people who walk in the door of the church, regardless of their situation or background.
One of the things it's clear listening to all of you share your different experiences that this has been clearly a very fraught process, clearly painful, a lot of strong emotions on all sides. But I have to say, looking on from as an outsider, I cover church politics here in the UK, and basically every denomination is going through a similar internal wrangling, mostly over this issue about same-sex relationships. This does strike me as a remarkably civilized, grown-up, professional way to try and when you get to an impasse where a portion of the church no longer feels they can walk together, the way the disaffiliation process has happened strikes me as remarkably civil. Is that fair, Heather? Is that how it seems to you, that actually, as the way that all churches could blow up, this is actually a remarkably one of the better ways of doing it?
I mean, don't get me wrong. Let me be very clear. Most churches have followed the discipline and have followed the process. We have had a few things end up in courts. So a couple of those cases are ongoing. Or not more than a couple, it's a few cases are ongoing, but we've had most of them resolved. I'll just put a note out there for anybody who's thinking about it. At this point in this history of our justice system, or our legal system, the trust clause has withstood a lot of challenges over the centuries. And so it continues to be kind of upheld and the church and the church law on this front. That's, I would love to tell you it was not rancorous at all. I think many cases again, what Megan says is absolutely right. That is a large number of people's experiences. But it, you know, sadness, but not anger. Unfortunately, it's not been universal.
And what would you say was the future for those remaining in the UMC? I mean, Bishop Tom made it clear that the division is not as simple as all the Conservatives have left and all the Liberals have stayed. Of course, that's crude. But clearly, the departure of 25% or whatever it is of the churches is going to change the internal voting balance at the next conference. Are there moves to try and change the Book of Discipline? Is the One Church plan coming back? Like, what's next now that disaffiliation has happened on a large scale?
So General Conference, our big meeting, is coming up on April 23rd through May 3rd. We like to meet, and we meet long. Anyhow, when we all get together, and yes, please know, this is not new. There have been efforts to change the discipline, but we will be seeing a lot of different delegates. And by the way, not just from the U.S., but also from other parts of the world, Africa included. And the real answer is, I don't know what will happen because only God does. But I do know that we are going to be dealing with some different people. And we have this legislation that always comes very different. It's not going to be constructed like the One Church Plan was. It's going to be, but trying to deal with different parts of the discipline. Please know this is a big meeting. We have lots of on our plate, including having potentially passing a full communion agreement with the Episcopal Church here in the U.S., so the province of the Anglican Church here in the U.S. And so that, you know, we've got a lot going on, but that's part of it. And as far as the church staying, I really want to drive this point home. I regret everybody who's left. It makes me very, very sad. But at the same time, I do want to say this. Most have stayed, but, and I'm sure Timothy would want me to mention this, that basically we do expect that there will be legislation on the floor, not just to change the discipline related to LGBTQ inclusion, but also regarding disaffiliation. We could potentially see that extended. We could see that broadened. So that is also on the table. Hope that was helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Really helpful. We're coming to the end, but a final few questions, and maybe zooming out a little. Timothy, can I come to you first? Do you think this kind of schism, if I can use a horrible word that people don't really like, but this schism was inevitable given the kind of cultural seas churches are sailing in, the way that cultural broader issues around sexuality have changed? Obviously, gay marriage is legal in a way that it wasn't 10 years ago. Do you think it was always going to end up with a large proportion of UMC churches deciding they couldn't stay within the same denomination, or could it have been avoided if things had panned out differently?
No, I think in some ways it was inevitable. I think if you go back to the period like 1857 to 1880, we had a similar thing that happened in us regarding the holiness tradition. A big Methodists becoming much more economically advanced at that time. They wanted better houses. We had very, very strong views about how you should live, different views about dress and holiness. And the result was we had a big split, and we had a whole new denomination formed in that time, the Free Methodist Church. So we've had Wesleyans, Free Methodists, Nazarenes. We had quite a few emerging movements over the past years from our movement in various ways. This, of course, this all predates the United Methodist Church, but in our own heritage. So I do think we will, it'll continue to happen again. I think that this is what's happened before. And I think we can learn from that. The fact that it happened already in the PCUSA and the American Baptist, Lutheran, et cetera, we were the last major mainline denomination to have this split. I think it was pretty obvious that it was just a matter of time before it came to us. And I think Megan and Heather were right. If it weren't for the African delegates, it would have been split long ago. So I think it was inevitable, a matter of time. And I think that none of us, I think, were surprised. As sad as it was.
Bishop Berlin, do you agree that it was inevitable in some sense? Or do you think if things had worked out differently, that there was a future for a kind of quite theologically diverse UMC with people with a wide range of beliefs, including those who hold very kind of traditional views and see that as, you know, uncompromisable?
So that diverse denomination, United Methodist Church, with diverse views actually exists today. It's the one I'm a leader in. and so what we have is, the most important work humans do is self-definition. It's how we become adults. It's how we become mature adults. And that's how we become wise adults. And so the people who remain in the United Methodist Church, they've actually decided to remain United Methodist now. 100% of the people that are now in the United Methodist Church are not there because they were born into it or it was the closest to their house. I think all those individuals have kind of said, you know, I got to decide if I'm in or I'm out. No one made them. They weren't forced to. but just the separation itself did that. And that was an act of self-definition. Can I handle the complexity of multiple views in one room? Can I handle the Sunday school class where not everyone agrees with me? How do I feel about gay people? Am I willing to really include them fully or not quite fully? And so, and that's by the gay person's definition, not by the straight person's definition. And so I think that we've been doing that work. Was it inevitable that people would leave? I don't think anything in human life is inevitable. I think it's choice. And I'm not saying it was a bad choice. I'm just saying it was a choice. We tried the protocol. We tried working, you know, formally for 2019 at the General Conference. Then we tried a protocol of grace and reconciliation, but it ended up being a separation agreement, not a unity agreement. So the United Methodist Church I lead today does not have unanimity. It does not have agreement on everything, but it does have unity in the body of Christ among people who believe that such things are possible.
And a final question then, for people from other denominations who are wrestling with this exact same division, would any of you say the way the Methodists have tried to figure this out is a model to follow, is a model that could be replicated in other churches, or would you say this is a cautionary tale to avoid?
You know, in the history of American schisms, the United Methodist one has gone over pretty well. I cover a couple different denominations, and so nothing's perfect. And one of the things that I think has been a hallmark is talking to some of the leaders in the revival movements or the renewal movements who are so conservatives within the UMC. And I mentioned to them that I think that they seem to kind of have a sense of, you guys have a vision for how this is going to work. And this one individual I talked to said they had been in talks with the Episcopal Church, with leaders in the Presbyterian Church USA, two mainline denominations that have split, and kind of garnered some of their wisdom so that they could learn from the mistakes and the wounds of others in hopes of doing division as wisely as possible. And so I think if denominations feel as though this is the way we're moving, I think consulting with others who have been down the road and saying what worked, what didn't, is always a wise step.
Anyone else on that same question? A cautionary tale or a model to follow? Bishop Palmer, perhaps?
It may be a bit of both. Megan talked about how denominations have learned from each other, and there are multiple sides to that learning. One side is, and I was told this by a denomination that's already been through this, by the presiding bishop, that to a T, there is a playbook that is being run in the mainline denominations. As in my opinion, it turned out that, you know, it has to be aligned to the polity of the church. But that leader in that denomination, which will go nameless, to a T, it has happened among us, polity issues notwithstanding, as it has among three or four others. I think that could be laid, so to speak, at the feet of other organizations that agitate this work in church denominations. So I'll be kind enough today, so I won't have to go to confession at 5 o'clock, to not name the organization. But anybody that's awake, it shouldn't be that hard. So I would say some yes and some no on cautionary. I mean, in one way, we have come out of it okay, but we don't know yet. we're not completely through all of the outcomes of what we've been through. And so in a sense, we don't know what we don't know yet about ourselves as the United Methodist Church. Third observation, this picks up on things that I think Bishop Berlin and Ms. Hahn offered. I don't want to be in a church where there can't be some robust mixing it up theologically. If we end up as a denomination of cookie cutter Christians and cookie cutter congregations, where there's no contour, shading, color, and nuance, aside from being pretty dull, we will not be at our best. And that's the saddest part to me of some of the coming apart, is that engagement with people where there are differences, while there may be some health not to stay in a place that you don't feel is healthy for you, there is some unhealth also in not having sort of walking away from robust engagement where you're likely to have some disagreement. And I don't mean that as only intellectual exercise, but as soul work, as work of the soul. And I think there are some other examples in the history of the church. There have been lots of schisms and divisions, but some other examples where people stuck it out because they were really compelled and driven by a mission. I mean, I wish we could have a great fight on every Christian in every denomination would say they don't believe there should be any hungry children in the world. I know that's a pretty simple example. Let's have the fight about how we can make that true. And let's stick together. Let's stick together. You know, every I can think of all the things that we are in agreement on with multiple church traditions. And my fear, and that's why I say we don't know what we don't know yet, is we have to prove to ourselves as the United Methodist Church, as we are now, who we have, if we can really, let me say, get on mission and stay on mission. This has been disruptive, and it has been draining away from missional focus. I'm not saying good things haven't happened in conferences, churches, and denominationally, but not as much good has happened because we had to put energy on this.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. We've hit 1 hour, and I must release you all back to the rest of your day. But I'm really grateful for all of your time. So thank you, Bishop Gregory Palmer, Bishop Tom Berlin, Heather Hahn from United Methodist News, Timothy Tennant from Asbury University, and Megan Fowler. Really great to speak to you all. Thanks for coming on the show. And thank you for everyone else for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye. That's it for this week's Premier Christian Newscast. But before you go, please do leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. And why not tell a friend about the show too? And if you'd like even more church news analysis, you can also subscribe to my new free email newsletter, The Critical Friend. Each week, I send an email packed with links to interesting things happening in the church world and my commentary on them. Just visit tswyatt.substack.com. to find out more and subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Premier Christian Newscast.